content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll wrap up the January issue of Our State Magazine with one of the regular columns, Ramblin' Man, and two new columns, Streets with a Story and At Home Here. We'll start out with Ramblin' Man, and the article is entitled, The Art of the Lure. In the depths of winter, what's an angler to do? Settle in, tie a mess of flies, and dream of spring fishing. Freezing rain is my favorite. A solid few hours of icy drizzle whittles away at the options. What else are you going to do? You'd be crazy to drive a car in the stuff. You need to stay close to home in case the power goes out. Even the front porch steps will push your luck. Given these conditions, there's only one sane activity to engage in during a steady, sloppy, slippery bout of freezing rain. Tying a bunch of flies. Trout flies, bass flies, flies for false saltwater redfish and bluefish, and any and all of them. If ever there were time to spend stupid amounts of money trying to make fake bugs and minnows in the hopes of catching real fish weeks and months later, the stir-crazy days of deep winter seem tailor-made. Add freezing rain, like that glazing the branches outside my kitchen window, and I go running for my tying vise, snips, thread, bobbins, tinsel, glues, and hooks, fake eyes, multicolored markers. If you didn't know how crazy I am about fly fishing, you'd think I was opening a Build-A-Bear workshop, except for the snoring dog at my feet and Julie in the playroom doing TV yoga. When Julie won't drive to the yoga studio, the weather must be seriously treacherous. Fly tying is the art, craft, and obsession of hand-making small, even tiny lures for fly fishing. It's a mashup of knitting, sculpture, macrame, painting, welding, and petit point, a form of needlepoint using even smaller needles. It's equally a mashup of science and art, instinct, and craft. To turn a bare metal hook into an assortment of fur, feather, tinsel, and glue into a simulation of something tasty, a shiner minnow, a mayfly, a leech, yum, is an art form that goes back to Macedonian anglers in the 1st or 2nd century A.D. They attached red wool and feathers to hooks in hope of fooling fishes of a speckled hue. Since anglers are doing pretty much the same thing centuries later, it's safe to say the Macedonians were onto something. As soon as I hear the words wintry mix, I pull my tub of fly tying materials out of the basement with plans to convert the kitchen into my workshop. I clamp a specialized vise that holds fishing hooks on an arm above the table. Then I heap up a small mountain of dyed deer tails, glittery tinsels, synthetic fibers, duck feathers, squirrel hair, and approximately 67 tubes of various glues. Julie insists that she doesn't like eating dinner from a plate surrounded by dyed animal parts and stick-on eyeballs, but I know she does. She really does. And then I'm again. The vise holds the fishing hook steady while I wrap the hook, shank, and waxed thread. It's a tedious, technical, and completely absorbing. Had you told my younger self I would one day spend hours with a thread bobbin in hand making dainty whip stitches, my younger self would have called you nuts. Once I cover the hook shank in thread, I wrap it with heavy wire, allowing the fly to dip and dart in the water. Next, I attach a fingerful of chartreuse deer hair with more tiny thread wraps. Wrap, wrap, wrap. There's a cadence to the process that's nearly hypnotic. Next comes a hank of glittery synthetic hair. Wrap, wrap, wrap. Dab of glue. Wrap, wrap. To tie a fly means building the creature from the inside out. I attach a piece of pearlescent tubing to the hook and compress it so the tubing flares into a vaguely minnow-like shape. I gingerly attach a plastic eye. And now comes my favorite part, painting the body with clear epoxy. Scissors, markers, glue, I feel like I'm 4 years old again. Except this is a dubious business. Tying flies is an act of deception. I'm creating something fake so it will be mistaken for something alive. And I do so out of things that once held life. Feathers, hair, strips of fur. I do my best to create a lie so that I can cast my fake to a fish. A second lie. To be followed by a third lie, most likely when I tell my friends what happened next. But tying flies is also an act of faith. On a dreary, sleety, freezing rain winter afternoon, I trust there will be fish in the rivers of spring, and I have faith that they will be hungry. That's where the real beauty lies in these flies I tie, hardly in my rough attempts at the fly itself. Alone in the kitchen, as freezing rain garlands the backyard trees and shimmer, I think of where I'll cast these flies on a warm spring day. On the Roanoke River as it tumbles across the fall line, or the Cape Fear where cypress trees crowd the banks, or the Wide Noose as it grades into Pamlico Sound. Without moving from my fly-tying table, I travel across the state to my friend's Parm Pond in Johnston County, where largemouth bass cruise the tangled banks, to a certain section of a certain mountain stream where the brook braids into three cascades that tumble into a dark pool bordered by dark timber. I know which rock I have to stand behind to make an accurate cast. Rap, rap, rap. I know I need a fly that will sink quickly. Rap, rap, rap. To lure a brown trout out from its lair of ancient sunken timber. Wrapping wire around the body of a fly called a woolly booger, I think, oh man, that iridescent chenille looks so good. My younger self, of course, would not have known chenille from chiffon from a burlap sack. I cut a snippet of crinkled tinsel and turn it into the glinting scales of a red-side dace minnow. White deer hair for the belly of a chub. Crescent of red marker for a slash of gill. The trees outside the kitchen window bow low with their freight of ice. Branches crack. Overhead lights flicker and pop. I hope I have gas for the generator. You'd be crazy to travel in such weather, but I'm nowhere to be found. In my fly boxes are hundreds of flies, each one a passport to a future memory in a distant place, and already I'm halfway there. And now to introduce Streets with a Story, a new column. It says, discover the road where North Carolina's past and present converge. North Churton Street in Hillsboro. Where most people see paintings and other fine arts and crafts through the windows of Hillsboro Gallery of Arts, Alexa Chavius Jennings sees the creaky-floored, penny-canny-stocked shop of her childhood. I'm sure it had an actual name, but my mom always called it the Five and Dime, she says. My fondest memories were going there. Chavius Jennings could count on making the trip to North Churton Street several times a month. The youngest of nine, she knew how to keep her nice footwear tucked away. Those were for church. And this called for playing shoes. It was a 15-minute walk at a steady pace, but they'd often stop along McAdams Road, an offshoot of North Churton, to visit with aunts and uncles and grandparents who were out on their porches. Though the street has changed through the decades, so much remains the same. Today, at 56 years old, Chavius Jennings and her husband, Mike Jennings, still live in the cinder block home where she grew up, and when she passes by the gallery, she can't help but think of those visits to the Five and Dime. With family roots that go back to antebellum Hillsboro, her lineage is woven into the town's history. Hillsboro has tried on several names since it was founded in 1754, Corbintown, Childsboro, and finally in 1766, Hillsboro, in honor of Wills Hill, the British Secretary of State for the colonies. Soon after the town became the center of the Regulator movement, farmers protested corrupt officials and unfair taxes, an early sign of the colonists' revolutionary fight for fair government. Courtney Smith has spent countless hours digging through records from this time, uncovering a slew of historical anecdotes and mapping businesses from past to present. It's no small feat considering that Hillsborough's historic district on the National Register of Historic Places features more than 100 buildings from the 18th and 19th centuries. "I'm up there going down rabbit holes," she said, nodding to her office on North Churton Street. Smith is the exhibits and programs coordinator for the Orange County Historical Museum, but her work extends far beyond that title. After moving to Hillsborough in 2020, she realized there was a gap in information about bygone businesses on Churton Street. Her commitment to research has led to an award-winning website, churchandstreet.org, that features detailed maps of businesses from 1754 to the present. "I remember my parents taking me to the National Portrait Gallery," Ms. Smith says. "I look at these portraits of people from colonial days and wonder what they would be like if they were walking around now. And I still do that." In her office, Smith often sits by a lunette window surrounded by archival boxes, reading old newspaper advertisements for businesses with directions like, "Start at the stone and walk toward the tree 40 paces." Despite the head-scratching such artifacts can now cause, Smith is drawn to uncovering bit by bit how the buildings that enliven the heart of this historic town, the ones that live brilliantly in the memories of locals like Chavius Jennings, came to be. Some things to do in Wilmington in Hillsborough on Churton Street. And there's Antonia's. This restaurant serving handmade pasta and cocktails was once home to the first state treasury before it moved to Fayetteville in 1789 and then to Raleigh in 1795. Then it aided in transferring another kind of asset, hooch. In the basement, there's still a Prohibition-era tunnel the width of a 5-gallon bucket rumored to branch out to each corner of the street above. Their website is antoniashillsborough.com. There's Kim's Bake Shop. A circa 1940s James Pharmacy sign welcomes guests to a shop stocked with an ever-changing selection of donuts, cookies, and more. The mint-colored tile floor is original to the pharmacy, along with the back bar mirror promoting Dr. Pepper behind rows of mugs and coffee presses. Check out their website at downtownpies.com. Then there's the Wooden Nickel Pub. Next door, this local favorite, which sources much of its meat from its own farm, serves up burgers, wings, and unexpected specials like pot roast grilled cheese. The walls are collaged with photos of employees and patrons, and the standing bar is carved with names of regulars from over the years. The website is thewnp.com, thewnp.com. Then there's the Orange County Historical Museum. Over nearly two centuries, this lot held a burial ground, two churches, a schoolhouse, and the town library. The stone building there today, where experts have shared artifact-based storytelling since the early 1980s. OrangeHistoryNC.org. There's the Old Town Cemetery. Intricate headstones mark notable local figures and families at one of the state's oldest municipal cemeteries. Founded in 1757, the burial ground is where esteemed brick mason John Barry and William Hooper, a sign of the Declaration of Independence, lie in rest. There's the Burwell School Historic Site. Docent Carol McKenna guides visitors around this 1821 site where the Burwell family started a school for girls. Diaries recount schoolhouse routines. Furniture showcases the work of free black cabinet maker Thomas Day. And a storyboard shares the experiences of Elizabeth Keckley, an enslaved young woman who worked for the Burwells and later bought her freedom. Their website is burwellschool.org. The Hillsborough Arts Council has been a cornerstone for creatives for decades, organizing events like the Art Walk and Makers Markets. Its gallery and gift shop features pieces from more than 60 local artists. HillsboroughArtsCouncil.org. There's Matthew's Chocolates. Before going in to choose a truffle, look for a faint carving reading Hillsborough Branch and a bank deposit box. These are the last vestiges of a bank before the General Assembly reinstated the UG at the UGH, I should say, at the end of the town's name in 1965. There's C3 Hillsborough. A subtle sign of this co-working space's past life is around back. An outline in the brick shows where an elevator used to transport goods at the bazaar, one of the state's largest department stores in the late 1900s. C3Hillsborough.com. And around the corner, there's Yonder, Southern Cocktails and Brew. Enjoy literary events and live music in a cozy lounge on King Street, on West King Street. YonderBarnNC.com. The Colonial Inn. Stay the night at this 1838 inn featuring an original staircase and reclaimed wood at 153 West King Street. There's the website is colonialinn-nc.com. And Carlisle and Lenny Vintage Jewelry. Browse a curated collection of jewelry from the 1800s through the 1970s. They're at 112 South Churton Street in Hillsborough. And a new column, At Home Here. In every corner of North Carolina, there's someone whose story captures the heart of where they live. And this article is entitled Meet Mr. Mayberry. And before I read the article, I'll tell you that that's on also the front page of the of January issue is The Making of Mayberry, How Mount Airy Went from Granite City to TV Icon. And there's a grayed out sort of picture of Andy Griffith in the background behind one of the cars that is one of the sheriff cars. From the stone that built Mount Airy, one man shapes a living story of community. In Mike Cockerham's hometown, I spot granite everywhere. I see a home, a bank, a public library, a post office, and even a few churches built with the chalk-white rock unearthed from the city's mammoth granite quarry. Mike calls this place home, Mount Airy, nicknamed the Granite City. He tells anyone who asks that he was born and raised in Mount Airy. His great-grandfather worked at the quarry, having moved his family to Mount Airy for that job. His grandfather, a brick mason, needed quarry granite for his work. I don't need to ask for what. Mike shows me. He pulls his Ford pickup beside First Baptist Church and points to the 107-foot bell tower beside North Main. He then tells me about the man he calls Papa. In the late 60s, when I was a kid, Mama would drive by here in the car, and he'd be up on a scaffold building that bell tower right there, Mike says. He'd be up there laying that granite. That's some heavy stuff, brother. Mike is proud of how granite, known in the construction trade as Mount Airy White, connects with his past, but his present is powered by a 1960s squad car in a place we all know as Mike first discovered that fictional town with the help of a woman named Mutt. When my mom had to go to work, she dropped me off at Mutt's house, Mike tells me. I was about 5 years old, and I'd be there on the floor in front of her round picture tube TV, and my first memories of television were watching in black and white the Andy Griffith Show and seeing Neil Armstrong walk on the moon. Being that young, I had no clue Andy was from Mount Airy. I just liked watching him and Barney. Well, didn't we all? Here's what I remember. I'm 5, maybe 6. I plant my elbows on the carpet in the den, position both hands under my chin, and lie stomach down a few feet from my family's big TV console. Television is a 4-channel universe, and I watch in black and white the escapades of Barney, Opie, Goober, Otis, Ernest T. Bass, and a small-town sheriff in ankle-high boots I know by one name, Andy. Mike has those memories, and he gave them wheels. In October of 2002, Mike sat for hours in front of a barricade in downtown Mount Airy, wearing a rain poncho and braving a downpour. He wanted a sweet spot up front to hear Andy speak. It was the actor's first public appearance in his hometown in 45 years. He's come for the dedication of the 11-mile section of U.S. Route 52 in Mount Airy to be named Andy Griffith Parkway. Before the ceremony, Mike met people from across the country who'd come to see Andy. When the rain stopped, Andy spoke for nearly 30 minutes, telling stories of growing up in Mount Airy and getting his own TV show. People started saying that Mayberry was based on Mount Airy, he told the crowd. Sure does sound like it, doesn't it? His fans cheered. Afterward, a bit awed by what he'd seen and heard, Mike started thinking. At the time, he was working third shift at R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, so his mornings and afternoons were free. And he's always loved tinkering on cars. You know what? He told himself. I'm going to build a squad car and give people a tour. A year later, he did. During his 37 years in electronics tech at RGR, a job that took him to Puerto Rico and throughout Europe, Mike never strayed from Mount Airy. He and his wife, Debbie, a social worker, raised two daughters here. After retiring, he devoted his time to his two car washes and his decades-long project, a 1967 Bolero Red Camaro RSS convertible. Then there was Andy. Mike began scouring the country to find Ford Galaxies built between 1960 and 1967. Over the next two decades, he bought seven and turned them into mirror images of what fans remember from the show. The whip antenna, black hood, black trunk, white doors, red dome siren on the roof, and a five-pointed star ringed with the word sheriff in a town known worldwide, Mayberry. Mike works under the hood and inside the cars to make sure they run and look like new. He now has a dozen part-time drivers to help him turn an hour-long trip in a Mayberry squad car into a bucket list moment. They ferry tourists around the city in a wide boat of a car. It lacks AC, has a speedometer that doesn't work, and burns a gallon of gas every 7 miles. But Mike's cars aren't meant to go fast. The drivers know the tourists want to look, and if those tourists get hot, they know they can go old school and roll down the windows. We're always going slow because the drivers are pointing, maybe stopping, and someone in the back saying, "Hold it a minute, I got to take a picture," says Mike, now 62. So a lot of people around town, they know. Don't get trapped behind a squad car if you're in a hurry. When I slid across the red vinyl seat in one of Mike's Ford Galaxies, I roll down the window and listen to Mike. Memories, long forgotten, come rushing back. When we crawl down East Haymore Street, we stop. I look beyond my open window and see what I later realize is the brick-and-mortar genesis of what's endearing about Mount Airy and Mayberry. It's a small house with no fancy facade. A sign tells me everything about the inextinguishable draw. Andy Griffith's home place, 1935 to 1966. When I ask a few drivers about where their carloads of tourists come from, they give me a geography lesson. Canada, England, Germany, Belgium, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and all 50 states. They all have stories, both poignant and funny. Norm Schultz, one of Mike's drivers, shares one. A few years ago, one of the passengers he took on a tour was a mother in her 20s, decorated with tattoos and wearing a nose ring. She drove down from Pittsburgh, a 6-hour trip, and brought her young son. Her dad, a big Andy fan, couldn't make it. Through tears, she told Norm why. He had died. She came for him. "You have no idea," she told Norm. "You helped us heal." Norm has a name for that. Mayberry magic. He says Mike is a big part of it. He still has that little kid joy of Mayberry inside him, says Norm, age 60. He's breaking his knuckles, taking care of the cars, but it's not just about business. It's about the business of Mayberry, the business of people. The more I listen and watch, the more I realize that what Mike does for where he lives brings him joy that's hard to describe, but so easy to feel heart deep. I hear it in a catch in his voice when he mentions his friends who've passed on. I see it when he gives the 11-year-old boy from Kentucky, a big Andy fan, a free squad car tours T-shirt and hears the boy say, "For me?" I sense it when we leave behind the turtle crawl of a Ford Galaxy and slip into his 1967 Camaro convertible. On roads he knows well, Mike shifts into fourth gear and opens it up. Over the roar of his muscle car, Mike shows me the open fields where he once primed tobacco from ages 8 to 16, the place where he played baseball for the Red Sox in the mid-1970s on an infield layered with granite dust. With the top down, Mike has to shout. As I listen, I understand why he never left and why he wants his hometown to remain vibrant and alive. He doesn't have to tell me. I know. For more information about the Mount Airy Squad Car Tours, visit tourmayberry.com. Well, to round out the broadcast, we'll have another little quiz from the Mic Check, talking about North Carolina's broadcast voices, past and present. And after World War II, Wilmington native David Brinkley began his NBC News career. From 1956 to 1970, he partnered with Chet Huntley on which nightly show? Was it A, David and Chet Report, or B, Brinkley-Huntley News, or C, Huntley-Brinkley Report? If you chose C, Huntley-Brinkley Report, you would be correct. Woody Durham, a 13-time North Carolina Sportscaster of the Year from Mebane, announced basketball and football games for which sports program from 1971 to 2011? A, Appalachian State Mountaineers, B, East Carolina Pirates, or C, UNC Chapel Hill Tar Heels? If you chose C, UNC Chapel Hill Tar Heels, you would be correct. At 17, Hattie Leeper became one of the Southeast's first African-American female radio announcers when she took the microphone at Charlotte's WGIV in 1951. Her natural talent soon earned her what nickname? Was it A, Happy Hattie, or B, Chatty Hattie, or C, Laughing Leeper? If you chose B, Chatty Hattie, you would be correct. She was also inducted in the 2025 North Carolina Music Hall of Fame, and she still lives in Charlotte. For 41 years, William Friday, hosted UNC TV's weekly North Carolina People, interviewing writers, educators, athletes, and politicians. What position did he hold at UNC? Was he the president, A, B, the chancellor, or C, the dean? If you chose A, president, you would be correct. Sandra Hughes had a nearly 30-year career at Greensboro FMY-TV and was Piedmont's first African-American woman with a daily talk show. What award, named from another North Carolina news legend, did she receive in 1981? Was it A, the Walter Cronkite Award, B, the Edward R. Murrow Award, or C, the Charles Kuralt Award? If you chose B, Edward R. Murrow Award, you would be correct. Well, that sounds as we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.